This is Elmer Witt on a Monday in September sometime, talking about God. And the first session is about mother, daughter, and undefined spirit. Let me tell you what my goals are. I'm going to be trying to question the way things are. And at first blush, that might sound like in behalf of the younger folk of the world, and that's true. But increasingly for the older folk of the world to whom God has some special meaning. And I'm not sure that the terms that we are using all the time in our whatchamacallit kind of a God are the most helpful and maybe necessarily the most biblical. And so I want to raise some questions about that for young and old alike. I'd like to provoke some response. I'll say some things that are pretty obviously geared that way. I hope that you will respond. I hope we can expand our vision and our vocabulary about God, with God, to God. I hope that through that we'd be able to reach folks with the richness of God's grace and keep folks in the excitement of the service of God. So those are my goals. Obviously, you don't have to respond. You don't have to say a word while you're here. You can sleep. You can daydream. At times, that may well be better. You may also respond. You indeed may disagree. Whatever. It'll be better if you respond. I think it'll be better. I'm convinced it'll be better. And it'll be even best if you disagree. I hate going to church meetings where nobody disagrees. So I hope you would be willing to pitch in. If you don't mind participating, I used to do a long kind of an exercise to get people started on this, but I found it took about a half of the period, which is not very bright. So if you don't mind, I'm going to streamline that and ask you to quickly respond out loud. Describe the physical appearance of Gorbachev.
Red rash.
All right. Yeah, well, go ahead. Anything.
Bald and birthmark.
Yep.
Birthmark.
What else?
Short.
Stocky. Anything else?
Big coats.
Sort of dour looking too, isn't he? At least my definition. Okay, fine. Describe the giant quickly. It's first thing that comes to your mind. The closest friends of George Bush that you know about.
The closest friends?
Yeah. Don't tell me their name. Just tell me what they're like. Describe them.
Portly.
Great. What else?
Powerful.
Powerful.
Rich. Somebody said rich.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
They're okay. Wasps.
Pardon?
They're wasps.
All right.
And rich.
Right. Describe for me quickly. First thing comes to your mind: the lifestyle of Madonna.
Materialistic.
What? All right. For those of you who know Madonna, I guess, obviously. Anybody else want to say anything about Madonna?
Showman.
Mm-hmm. All right. The basic message, this is even tougher. The basic message of Shirley MacLaine. Anybody know the basic message of Shirley MacLaine? And I'm going to say, what is it? I'm saying, what do you think it is? Tell me.
New Age.
Enlightenment.
New Age. Enlightenment. What?
We are God.
Okay. Good. What? Anything else? First thing that pops to mind.
Inner growth.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. That's all fine. Now I'd like to do the same for Jesus Christ. Would you? Describe his appearance. Quickly. First thing comes to mind.
Weird.
What else?
White, thin.
White, what?
Thin? Because of the...
Right?
Lanky.
Okay.
Is that fairly well built?
Uh-huh. Again, I'm not asking you, what does the Bible say Jesus looked like? I'm saying, what comes to your mind? What's in your mind about that? You've got some picture there. What
kindly.
Is it?
Kindly.
Kindly? Okay.
Gentle.
All right.
Forgiving.
All right.
Loving.
Okay, good. Describe his closest friends. Closest associates. What do you know about them?
Ruffians.
Okay.
Feisty troublemakers.
Okay. Again, I'm not saying, what does the Bible say about them? What's your impression? What's in your mind when you say, Jesus' disciples, friends, whatever.
Confused.
Peter was boastful.
Mm-hmm. Boastful, right?
The odds and ends of society.
Mm-hmm. Odds and ends, okay, good. The lifestyle of Jesus Christ, quickly.
Nomadic.
Simple.
Anybody else?
Open.
Yeah, if you want to get those, that'd be great. I have to interrupt myself by saying, the first thing I did, my first confirmation class in 47, was such a mess. I had to start, that's why I went into youth ministry. I couldn't go downhill, I could only go uphill from that, because the kids all ended up in a mess. So what I did is I taught them the story of the life of Christ first, and I spent about 2 months on that, until they could write their own story of the life of Christ. And then the rest of the confirmation class fit into that. And I'm always regretful when people don't have more things about the life of Christ to tell. When I do this story, it reminds me that everybody really, I would encourage everybody to be able to tell a story. What's it about? What's he like? Again, from your point of view as well. I mean, at least, you know? Okay. And the last one, what's the basic message of Jesus Christ? That you think? Not ask you, what did, what? Love?
Repent and be saved.
Okay. Say your own, whatever it is.
Forgiveness,
sure. Let me respond and then start my presentation. That helps me a little bit. My answer to the last question is, you ought to know my dad. You ought to know my dad. I think Jesus talked more about his father than he did about anything else. And the love and everything else came from the Father, and you really ought to know the Father who was there. And that image of God that we get through Jesus Christ is the kind of thing that I want to talk about. What is the image of God? I think most of us here, I don't know if all of us here are Christians or not, it doesn't make any difference to me if you are, but if you aren't, you have to let me know so I don't try to include you in everything, because whoever is here and whatever message they're bringing is part of the discussion for this evening. But what is that image that Jesus Christ brings into your life? And it is the words we use about God, I think, as well as the message that we understand those words to contain. I'm using some stuff that I heard, I don't know if Ralph, if you were at, it was at PLU last summer, when Terry Fretheim was there. Did you hear his lectures?
No, I wasn't.
Okay. Okay, then I'm free. I was there and attended, and I heard his tape once again. And it has to do with the imaging of God. And I'm using some stuff from that, plus some other things I put together. And then heading toward tonight, an imaging of God that has to do with a concern for inclusive language as well. The first two sentences that Terry Fretheim, he's a prof at Lutheran Northwestern Seminary, often comes up here to teach as well. His first two sentences were, it's not enough to say that you believe in God. It's just not enough. You have to be able to describe what kind of God in whom you believe. And that second part is what he was working on in his presentation. The image of God with which we live really matters, and these images that we have will help us shape our life for good or for ill, whether we are aware of it or not. And so what image of God we have is terribly important. And as I'll be going on to say, and certainly as Fretheim did that night, that day when we were there, it has an awful lot to do with the biblical images that we have received or that we haven't received at all. Many of us grew up distant from God in our connection with God. Some of us had the advantage. I grew up fairly distant from God. It was a very Lutheran home. very involved in the church, 8 grades of parochial school, but we rarely talked about God at home. God was not very present with us. I suppose if I had to summarize my childhood as they were doing last night, God lived at church, not at our house. Although we would have said he lived at our house, and we probably had a thing on the wall that said the unseen guest at every meal, but we never talked about him. My dad prayed every night and read scriptures, but never led us to. And I'm not blaming him. I take my own responsibility for that. Other people, like Terry Fredheim was describing this, grew up in a home where that was a very personal thing. God got into discussions all the time, and they talked about it. And there was an intimacy almost with God, that God could hear what they were saying and was even a participant in it. Fredheim's also bothered by the bad press that the Old Testament gets, the Old Testament God gets. I have to confess in front of Ralph here, who is an Old Testament scholar, I have always envied, if you permit envy, always envied Old Testament people. I think people who understand more about the Old Testament than surely most of us do have far greater advantages for understanding, I think, just about anything. Now, that's a hyperbole at least, but I think it's great to have some understanding of the Old Testament. And he thinks that God of the Old Testament, comes out normally. When you ask, well, what's the God of the Old Testament, especially the Christians? It's a distant God. It's a God of wrath, fire, and brimstone, a God that gets even, a God that strikes out almost capriciously and incomprehensibly. And that's the kind of God I think most people have out of the Old Testament. And that's really, really not fair at all to what the Old Testament says. Of course, if you want to be fair about it, the New Testament is pretty critical at times too, you know. It's in the New Testament that you find out about ending up in hell with the gnashing of teeth forever and ever and ever. In the Old Testament, when you die, you were dead. In the New Testament, it went on forever. So both of them have some tough parts in it. But the Old Testament normally comes off tough. People see Jesus pretty well in the New Testament and say, as you people did, love and gentleness and all the rest. But the Old Testament God doesn't come off that way. And so there's been more talk now about a view of God that is more inclusive than that standard one, that traditional one that has been used. And what bothered Fredheim was he felt that most historians, so Old Testament historians, were unexamining the images of God. They were just assuming that the images of God had to be that distant and that authoritarian kind of a God that was out just pushing people around and bashing people, whatever it may be. It seems to me, too, that we Lutherans, who on the one hand have such a warm and close effort, what we call a Christological emphasis, an effort to make Jesus Christ real, alive, close, intimate, friend, whatever, brother, sister, I'm a sister of Christ, whatever it may be, still have allow an imperious God from the Old Testament. And I suspect yet that most people have a tough time putting those two together. And that many people are distanced even from the loving Christ because of some background information that they're carrying about this tough God. What I'm willing to say that on the basis of what I've read and what Fredheim was saying, the common images of God in the Old Testament about God that are out and about among us now, that are highly monarchical and highly authoritarian, are simply not true to the text. The non-biblical patterns of thinking about God are really more bad habits than they are biblical studies. And the impact of that image of God on the mission of the church may really be a key stumbling block. If you press people why they don't join the church, people who are on the outside, press them. And you usually will find that it's because they don't like the God that you're dealing with. the image that they have received subtly, outside of the church or inside of the church, has been one that is tough hombre, going to get his or her due, and really very often is not open to any kind of suffering at all. And so, and this by the way is my experience in campus ministry, one of the things that kept people away most was a religious organization that had nothing or very little to say about why there is evil in the world, what we call evil in the world. Because when these folks experience suffering and find a God that doesn't, that distances himself from suffering, as the traditional image often describes, that person is not going to be turned on by the church. And so that image has to be worked at. There is more to be said, more to be done. There are over, I'm told, 50 images for God in the book of Psalms. Fredheim asked us as pastors to take any of our last sermons or all of our last sermons and count the images of God that we use. They would be terribly few. 5, 10 maybe, that we'd be conscious of using about God. So the limits that we have, the call for expanding isn't, well, why don't you go out and make up something, I'll be talking about that later on, but not even using what we've already have, especially the images of the Old Testament that are offered to us. So there are broader metaphors, materials for the image of God in the Old Testament. We tend to use the abstract language. Well, I remember how well I learned all of the attributes of God, right? You got them all down? You didn't have to memorize the way I did. The God being, supernatural, omniscient, omnipotent, infinite, invisible, impassible, unchangeable, immovable, immutable, transcendent. Everything up there, all pushed away from us. And people in the world around us looking for somebody to be here. And we talk about a incarnation in Jesus Christ and then have a tough God that's way out there that we have a tough time pulling back in, or that people sense. It doesn't make much sense to them if we say there's a God like that, but there's something else going on right here. It just doesn't seem to connect with the tough issues of the lives that we face. The language of interpersonal relationship, it seems to me, is the key language that we have to work on to bring that back to be. I think, again, that the contemporary movements, and here's where do some illustrating about the feminist movement at least, are raising questions that the old traditional image of God that we have allowed to happen. I'm not saying it's the one we affirm, it's the one if we were pressed in the corner, would say it had to be, but the one that really is with most people is not answering the questions that the movements around us are asking. I think the feminist movement is just not satisfied with the kind of answer that we imply by the image of God that we allow to be prominent when we talk about God, and especially when we talk about God outside of Jesus Christ. The liberation theology, obviously, in terms of oppression and the repression and that great suffering that goes on with one another, a distant God is very difficult to communicate to that person. The people who think that an egalitarian kind of society, a lot of people judge more a church today more by the style of its leadership than by almost anything else, is tough to get across when you have a God that is authoritarian and just has all the answers and is unneedy, doesn't respond to anything at all, just fiats and it's taken care of. And we don't reach those people. Those experience great suffering as well, seem cut off. And many of us, it seems to me, in what we call our witnessing or evangelism, are really hard-pressed to have not an answer. I don't think there is such a thing. But struggles toward an answer when we face up to the deep struggles. I experienced that with the death of my wife. I got some of the worst kind of counsel and comfort, in quotes, from Christians. Some from Christians' pastors. Friends were absolutely good to me. My family was very, very helpful to me. This was true both for the death of my wife as well as for the death of my daughter, who died at age 27. But I got much, I confess, walking out that road into God's creation and observing not just trees, but observing the death and resurrection that God has built in to the creation. That came through to me more strongly than Bible passages coming to me otherwise. So how the image of God that we have will affect that is what I think has been in the way of that. Why did Kushner write? Why did Kushner write? Why do bad things happen to good people? Why would it have to be Kushner? I'm glad it was a person who wrote it. And Jewish rabbis, or many of them, are my dear friends. I'm not picking on them at all. In any shape or form. But why wasn't that written by a Christian? I don't agree with everything in Kushner's book by any means, but it was a doggone good effort, and it was part of the struggle of why things like that happen. People will not accept the Christian faith, I believe, without an effort, without continuing effort to deal with that question. And I'm not talking about the people who want an easy answer, you know, put a nickel and get a response out. I think about people who want to be able to struggle with it as well. When something bad happens, you know, all the questions that we do have are, why me, Lord? Why evil anywhere? Will God still be there for me? These were questions, by the way, that Fretheim gave that were asked in Christian congregations. What are the questions you would like to have answered by the church? Listen to these, there are seven of them. Why me, Lord? Why evil anywhere? Will God still be there for me? How can I cope today? What is God's will for my life? And then the last two, what's Lutheran worship about anyway? And why don't I need to be born again? But the first five of those all dealt with me and my interpersonal life. Now, that doesn't mean we got to reshape the whole world to fit that. But if that's where people are, we ought to be using images of God that will meet them at that place. I think images of God have a way of sinking deep into our lives. And the effect is not such some intellectual kind of stuff, but I think they really do shape the life of the people who are there. And what Lisa was doing last night was, I think, historically accurate. Not only because the kid, jerked around and all that stuff, but because an image was being built of what it's like for kids. There's a book, maybe some of you have read it, by David Heller called The Children's God. And he made a formidable study of children by asking them to interview God, asking them to write to God, asking them to call God on the phone or whatever it may be. And the basic image that the children received, obviously through their parents, but through the church as well, pastors as well, was that the people who were connected with somehow God talk, God thinking, God faith, whatever it may be, were people who blocked questions. And who always communicated that all the answers had been had. And that parents and pastors and the church was a source of ready answers. Kids only get to be about 10 or 11, maybe earlier now, before they catch on, that's not so. That's not so. And if that's the case, there's a doggone good chance they're not going to respond with any depth to what's being said by the church. I think that I got to remember to tell Jeanette. I think that book ought to be at home. If it isn't here at home, maybe it is already. And Heller's, David Heller's The Children's God. And then he did another follow-up on talking to children about God, which is similar to that. So we talk about our king, our God is king. And sure, God is a king. But not the kind of king that the world is talking about. Not the kind of big entourage. The God that we have met has got his arms, got arms around unformed children and dirty prostitutes and rejected people. And that God's feet are dirty. And that God lives with the people and not in the castle. That's the twist of the Christian faith. That words are used that sound like, you know, our king comes to us, like it's all settled, he's taking over, let's mow him down and get rid of him, we'll send in another 100,000 troops to Saudi Arabia and we'll take care of it. Not so. This is a God that comes meek and gentle. And it's more like eagle's wings. And they could be pretty flimsy. 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 feet in the air. Different kind of image that it's possible for us to have. So, two more things and then I'll stop. And then I want to say something about need for inclusive language as far as our women in the world are concerned. There are first thing to say is every one of the images of God has limits. There is a yes and a no to every image of God. If we say God is our Father, there is absolutely true senses in which God is our Father. By the way, some images are deeper and better than others. I think Father is one of those. Not to have to say male, but to say Father. And what is implied, I think, in Mother as well, is a deep image of God. That's not the same as saying, as I think the Psalms say, that God is a she-bear. I think those are not equal kind of images. So there are differences. But that these images are all limited. Any one of them, any piece of language for God, we can say yes to, but we also have to say no to. So it adds to the continuity of what God's like, but at the same time, any image is in discontinuity. It doesn't fit all the way through. So we have to see to it that the kind of images that we have will fill in for one another rather than leaving us hanging with only one. The more that we understand God, the better that the images work, the less we will know God. Or say it a better way, the greater the mystery of God. Because the less we know God, we feel worse about it. But the greater the mystery. And the second contention is the greater the mystery of God, the more interesting God is. I don't know how we do this. I keep working, and I haven't been preaching much lately and teaching as much as I have opportunity to do. But my goal constantly will be now is to try and make it more interesting by pushing it more of the images for God so that we don't stop or get stuck with the images we have or we give those images new feelings. So God is interesting so that God will be attractive. And not what I'm afraid I'm saying is making it sound like is that we have to kowtow to people. People are out there bored, so we got to entertain them. I don't believe that. But I do believe there is so much to offer in the images of God that we haven't even gotten at it at all. What are the sources for that? So this is the last part. What are the sources? God's actions in history. We've said that when God causes the Exodus, that's a revelation about God. And we use that. We go on exoduses. The whole movement in the South for civil rights, based on that, we're going up to the mountain. Huh? All of it was really based on that kind of imagery. There was great kinds of imagery. That, in the Old Testament, was personal. None was distant. You know, you were able to interact with that person that was there. You were able to communicate with that person. There was something going on that was personal. And so our images for God, it seems to me, ought to be strongly relational as well. And the third kind of source, and this came from Fredheim as well, is that it was grown out of common human experience. The images for God came out of common human experiences. Like, one, human personality. Thinking, feeling, and willing. This is the images that God has in the Old Testament. Personal activity. The use of the mouth, the hands, the arm, the eyes, the feet. These are images for God in the Old Testament. The family, obviously. The husband, the father, the mother, the daughter, the son. Those images are there. That was relationships. Four, the social political areas, the friend, the king, the judge, these images are known for God. And then, and one of the biggest categories is the human vocational ones. The one of shepherd, seamstress, teacher, midwife, physician, metal worker, farmer, all of these things. Good old Lutheran emphasis on the calling that you have being the place where your life is worked out. And the imaging for God in the Old Testament having a strong tie with where people are ordinarily living and working things out is connected to the tradition about God. The God that they met way back there in whatever. The Exodus or in whatever that you can recall is the same God you meet here in this kind of situation that I am in. Sixth one is objects that people have made, which again in Old Testament, I'm told, are not impersonal, because what you own is part of you, and especially what you have personally made is an extension of yourself. And finally, the non-human things like rock, sun, light, eagle, mother eagle, something like that, outside of the human. But even these are given personal characteristics when they're used. So the push is towards the field of metaphors and talking about God that are relational, that have are almost all personal, that are ordinary, that are earthly, and that almost all of them are what we call secular. None of those images are religious. Those are secular images. So that's, it seems to me, is the push that we ought to be. How can we learn from that kind of feeling about imaging God for better ways of talking about God? Well, I think women's theology makes mistakes. All theologies makes mistakes. My theology makes more mistakes than most. There is no perfect theology. In fact, there is no perfection. One of the greatest drains on all human life is the image, the false image, the false belief, if you will, of perfection. Self-value is given to us or we don't have it at all. It's a grace gift of God. But we try to perfect these images and we want images of perfection all the time. That's what I think is some of the impatience with the women who are asking us as Christians to have new names, new ideas, and inclusiveness for God. I learned early on from my daughters and from my wife that there wasn't much hope for their connection with the church if being conscious of being able to use feminine names for God, feminine capacities for God, feminine attributes for God, and not to use them, they weren't going to stick around. Because that for them was unbelief and stubbornness. And so asking for new ways to do it, and asking for us to be inclusive, and asking for us to be uncomfortable, as some of us certainly would be, and certainly lots of people in parishes are, for sure. Bishop Chilstrom of the ELCA says that one of the four most frequent questions he gets in the mail is inclusive language, especially about God, but also about human beings. So they're bothered by it. But I think they're right in searching for it, in helping all of us to open up our own understanding, greater understanding of who God is and what God does, and where God is in connection with us, especially in those things that are primary in our kind of life in this world today. I think they're also, and I sat just about where Ralph was sitting, and another, I won't have to mention his name, prof was sitting over here, when we had a discussion about the Trinitarian, using Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. You have to use the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost formula, or you cannot be saved. Now, I don't know that he said all that, but he was doggone close to it. But then, sitting there, he explained why the Trinitarian formula was so important. And I was absolutely excited. It was really the best I had heard. And I held up my hand and said to him, was what you did just now sinful? You just said the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in different words. And it was great. I think the women of the church and the men of the church alongside them have the responsibility to find being faithful to the tradition that we have received. For me, that's scripture. That we should be able to find ways of saying even the Trinitarian formula in ways that are consistent and in ways that are inclusive to meet the needs of the people that are around us today. I'm willing to take stands about that just about any place. Sure, everybody says, sure, you're retired. You haven't got anything to lose. can't get a my pension. U.S. government protects me. But I think that it's an important thing to do because we will all, I believe, all learn and grow thereby. And we will be more of an open church, and I think the kind of church that we were called to be. I better stop. Reactions. I didn't push questions or anything at you, but I'd like your responses, disagreements, whatever.
I'm interested to pursue your idea about the Trinity. About 2 months ago, Walt Bowman was here, and there was a very heated discussion about the Trinity. It always has to be Father, Son, Holy Spirit, because of all these historical events that took place and all these decisions that were made by the early church. And we dare not go back and mess with something that's already been decided 1800 years ago because they knew better than we did. It was kind of the implication of we don't really understand the atmosphere that this decision came out of, and we're going to kind of, my impression was, we're going to kind of prostitute the whole notion if we kind of blindly go on and start changing words. That was his. Well, I shouldn't say that.
That's how you heard.
That's how I heard it.
Sure.
And
how'd you feel about it?
Well, I'm a history major, so I'm a little bit. Sympathetic to the historical argument,
sure.
But on the other hand, and I'm, you know, and I'm also very kind of sympathetic to the idea of traditions.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I'm not impressed with something that's so rigid that it seems really boring.
Yeah.
And dead. And but it's hard to argue with somebody that's 65 years old and has been...
Don't say that. He's not that old. He'd be very sensitive.
I know.
He's a dear friend, by the way. He's a dear personal friend of mine.
Yeah, so. And I know he's a very caring person all that. Yeah. But he definitely got his opinions.
Yes.
So, I'm just interested...
I'd be glad to say more, but I'd like to have some more responses first. Yeah, please.
in that connection, I remember once hearing, I think it was Yaroslav Pelikan, speaking about the Trinity, and I think what he said always remained in my mind. He said, it's just a kind of a shorthand of saying everything that you ought to say about God without falling flat on your face before you begin. So, in other words, he respected it, mm-hmm. much so, mm-hmm. and respected, I think, what you're talking about, the history behind it, mm-hmm. and its background. Mm-hmm. The point that I guess that, as a biblical scholar, I'd like to bring up is this. Let's take something that it's not quite so such a hot potato. The way in which the Gospel of John uses the word the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can, in order to avoid scandal when you read it, you can do what, say, Susan Greel does at PLD, mm-hmm. Stephen Pastor. She says the people of Judah. Mm-hmm. Or some people say Judea. That does avoid the scandal.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Brown, though, I think, and I don't second guess my pastors, he says, and he's a Roman Catholic scholar at the Union,
yes.
and he feels that if you keep that offensive statement there, the Jews, that people will then be driven to ask questions of the Bible and will learn something. Now, it's kind of up for grabs, and I would venture to say the one side that changes it or the other side is wrong. I think you have to have Christian love, and as you said, I think I like that. We know in part, we prophesy in part.
Yeah,
and sure. We'll realize that more and more as we go into that. I must say, holding here the inclusive language makes me perhaps think more of the Trinity and what its real meaning is than if we just had the formula.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a response.
Good. Thank you, Rob. Someone else?
I'd like to respond to
it. Oh, please, come.
The issue of the historical context, I too have respect for that. But what is the church but the people and the experiences out of which we are currently find ourselves? We are the church. And to discount that experience creates a personal pain for me as a woman, where my experience is different from the male experience. I think one of the things that I get frustrated, and I'm really tired of having an inclusive language discussion since I've been in it for a few years, is that I like what you had mentioned with your wife and daughters, feel that I need to be apologetic about using pronouns of her and she when there's never apologies made for him and her, or him and he, or to talk about the mother God. And at some point I just get really sick and tired of that.
Mm-hmm.
That what is inclusive does not mean exclusive. Those two are not always in contradiction. Inclusive is the opportunity to recognize God in both male and female imagery, and to recognize that each one falls short at some level. That's who we are. If we were more than that, we probably wouldn't require God in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Good. Thank you. Someone else? We go to what, 20?
Yep.
Thank you. Yes.
As you said, the Old Testament has so many images of God. Why do you think Jesus Christ, as we know him, saw mm-hmm. fit to tell people about God mm-hmm. in one image?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that was important? And what,
well,
what does that mean for us then?
I think the image Father is a basic image, and I would add to it Mother, personally, because I think that what's loaded into the Father image has both of those in there. and that in a society like ours, which I think is different from the society that Jesus is in, I have the gall to believe that Jesus would have said it differently. I don't think that, you know, one can say from this perspective, this is the way Jesus said it to be forevermore. I think he responded. He didn't talk to a chair, but it was a person that was in need. You know, he didn't say, chair, thy sins are forgiven thee. He responded to what was there, and I think Jesus would have responded too. And I think that was loaded so much, the Father image is so loaded, that we haven't unpacked it at all. We've let it, I think, often become a male, exclusively male image. And I think it's, I'll be frank to say, there are mostly lousy fathers in the world, I believe. Now, I'm coming out of my counseling background, and I'll say it this way, many of us, including myself, are not good fathers, haven't been good fathers. And that puts a burden on it. Now maybe the scandal that Robert Brown says, you know, let the scandal be there, we are bad fathers. I'm willing to let that happen. But I also want the people to get inside of it and not be knocked off from it and be able to think about the depth of a father image more so than we are able to, I think, in this kind of a world. A father has been, I think it's not an inaccurate, but an inadequate image for God. So I'm not against it, I just think it isn't enough. And I think we're called upon to take more of them and be using them. The God of creation that Jesus talked about a great deal of the time is also part of that image. It was a very strong aspect of Jesus' preaching as well. So that would be my response to that. Up there first.
I was just thinking, it seems like in Jesus' time, when Jesus used the Father image, Jesus was bringing something positive to the Father image because of who Jesus was and because how Jesus experienced God. And it's hard for us to relate to that, but it could be that, you know, the way that how it was for people living then, mm-hmm. you know, it was a positive thing.
Mm-hmm. Could be. I don't know about that. I'd like to know more about that. Was it a good image? You know what I'm saying? I don't know. I think it's an intriguing question, and I don't know if we can find out for sure either. You know, what do we do? How do we prompt by it? But that may well be, and I'd be wide open to saying yes. That's a good one. Let's work on it. But again, I would say there are others also. Yeah, Ralph. Yeah.
Well, just in that sure. connection that you just spoke about, earlier said that our culture doesn't have this, mm-hmm. and we aren't able to speak adequately. That has to be still brought. And what you were saying about fathers, I think about human beings. We can't really. We're at the stage of developments where we are. You can't really give a good definition of human being because you can't nail it down with some ancient description, as good as they were, even the biblical ones, in the light of the future to which the risen Christ is calling everyone, mm-hmm. to a new humanity. We'll just have to work that out. And in, I think, forbearance, knowing the limitations of being a father or a mother.
And then I would add to that, along with the forbearance, the openness to new ones based on the premises of the ones that we have received. If they have been mostly relational, then we ought to be looking for more that capture some of that as well to help us to share the expanse that is there. Walt Bowman was saying about things haven't been settled back there. Well, I think that's unbiblical to think that way, frankly, and I would tell Walt that. Things haven't been settled. We're still, as Ralph says, we're still in the struggle today. They were then, too. Because we have agreed about something in the past doesn't mean that it was the only right thing, because those are still all human beings working. And I think it's so terribly Lutheran for us to be calling things like this into question of all the people who get upset when things get stymied and get socked into one way. We ought to be the people who are scrunching, because that's, we came from that kind of stuff. We crawled out from under with a great deal of pain and a great deal of harm, I might add. It wasn't pure by any means at all. But we ought to be willing to do the same thing. And that will be a struggle. And that will be speaking the truth in love. You know, if we're out just to prove somebody wrong or get somebody or get even, of course, that kind of possibility is always there. But that's not the goal that we have for the images of God. I'd like to talk more about tomorrow night when we talk about the different strokes. That's going to be on the basis of Jaroslav Pelikan's book that Ralph just mentioned, Pelikan, on his Jesus through the centuries. And the names for Jesus, this is from the outside looking in, the kinds of names that centuries brought to bear on Jesus Christ, different by the ages, all the way through. Intriguing study. I like the book very much. Jaroslav happens to be a classmate of mine, so I always hope a little brushes off on me that he writes marvelous books. You know? And then we're talk about the vulnerable God. Fretheim's basic message is that God changes. God changes. God responds. It's relational. And we'll be talking about that. And we'll be talking there again about suffering and grief as well on that. And then we want to talk about the gutsy God, that there are values that we cannot run away from, and that we're not talking about making this over to look like us or namby-pamby, whatever it may be. Take on some of the stuff today that I think is an abuse of seeking new names for God. I'd like to talk a little about that. And then at the end, that this is all done in community. I think in the Christian faith, Muriel doesn't have a right to go off and make up her own names about God and saying this is the way it should be. But that Muriel is called to be part of a community that struggles with that. And that's what I hope that Holden is. Not just saying, well, you know, we could figure it out. I've rarely found that attitude here, but it's certainly possible anywhere where the human beings. But that we are part of a community that does it. And that talking about how that elusive community, because who is it? Is the ELCA or is it the Baptist? Does it include the Methodists? Or does it include the Missouri Synod, of course, as well, whatever it may be? What is that elusive community that helps us shape it? I'd like to talk a little bit about that, because I think we get a little foggy. I get a little foggy about what that kind of community is like. So you're invited to come and share with that as well. Thanks much for the time that you spent tonight.